Chapter 10 Mirror Stage. Emily and I began to tour together. It was sublime. We would visit museums, and she always had some interesting spot in the city she wanted to check out. Best of all, we would work together. Because we looked so similar, nearly half of our bookings were doubles. Appointments with Emily became the absolute highlight of my career. I think the two of us were so in love that even the dullest booking was transmuted by how badly we wanted each other. Things that might usually be deeply revolting became the pinnacle of pleasure, all because I was doing them with her. I think with her, I truly began to understand that it is not the acts themselves, nor the skill with which they are done that brings pleasure. Someone could move their tongue with all the talent in the world and leave me feeling nothing. Desire is so elusive. After years of dating this girl, obsessed with her beauty and her mind, she told me that halfway through our time seeing each other, she had gotten a nose job. She said it as though it was a shameful thing I must have noticed, but didn't mention out of some sort of noble impulse not to embarrass her. I hadn't noticed the change. In the time that I'd known her, she's changed her body in many ways. Tattoos, piercings, different sorts of plastic surgery coming and going, and her body itself has changed through the course of time. I told her recently she could do anything at all to her body, and I'd probably still be just as obsessed with her. She laughed and smiled. Agreed. Usually when I was traveling internationally, Anna would travel with me. She would refuse to leave the hotel unless it was for a photo shoot. When we were in Paris, she wouldn't deign to visit a single museum and whined when I wanted to eat anything besides hamburgers. I only got to eat 2 pieces of sushi in Tokyo because she only wanted to eat pasta. I think we went to 6 Italian places and only 1 sushi restaurant our entire time in Japan. Deeply tragic. I felt immense sadness. All these beautiful photos of all the places I felt like I had never visited, because I almost never got to truly take a day off or roam around. It's hard to remember the exact tipping point where I went from making a solid living doing sex work to making an obscene amount of money. Part of that is because Anna spent it all, and because I was working too much to enjoy any of it. For most of my life, even my childhood, I have such distinct and clear memories. But the years spent living with Anna are a depressing, indistinguishable slog. I was always so anxious with her. Everything was a massive disaster. She would show me massive credit card bills and say we would be in incredible debt if I didn't do another tour. I couldn't figure out where the money was all going. I do remember when it felt like the work started to change. When it went from feeling mostly benign or even fun to being mostly intolerable. When it all started to blur together. It's a cliche that people recommend curatives to people in the depths of depression that they are too depressed to be able to do. Brush your teeth, drink some water, meditate, exercise, do some yoga, go to the beach, spend time with loved ones. When you're in the depths of it, these hot tips feel insulting, like the people suggesting them have no idea what pain you are experiencing. Of course, as I've grown older, I've learned that these things do help, at least to some extent. But when I was in the darkest periods of my life, I don't think any amount of all natural assistance would have helped. I needed drastic changes, sometimes changes to things that felt like they were out of my control. Being a teenager is hard. Your brain still isn't fully developed, so you need the guidance of adults in your life. You're also at the age, though, where the cracks in the competence of the adults surrounding you begin to show. Pharmaceuticals helped me during this time because they numbed me. Experiencing my life raw and unfiltered at that time would have been absolutely unbearable. I mean unbearable in the sense of unlivable, something that I couldn't have survived. I would have killed myself. Now that I have real agency, now that I'm in the driver's seat of my life and I'm really starting to trust my own judgment, when I experience stress or pain, holistic curatives are what I turn to. Yoga, meditating, going for a hike, calling a friend. These are all coping mechanisms that are enough to carry me through bad times these days. If we want to experience love, we will by necessity experience pain. Of course, we can limit our attachments if we want to follow that path, but that has never been my way. I love love, relationships, caring for others and things, appreciating beauty, and mourning tragedy. I have no desire to be enlightened because for me, so much of the joy of being alive is the burden of it. The work of living and loving and caring is what brings me satisfaction, putting it all into balance. I like to think of myself as a hippie. Not the type to join a death cult, but the type to play around with chemicals in the lab, perhaps a professor at Berkeley. It's easy to forget that many hippies are very much scientists. There is an image of them as purely new age and full of flimflam. I wonder how differently it would have turned out if there had never been a war on drugs. Why are people in power so obsessed with controlling spirituality and pleasure? Of course, it's how they maintain their power. By controlling people's access to pleasure, in all senses of the word, they're able to control the people. Drugs, sex, music, food, art, exercise, hard work, dwelling spaces, worship, and even friendships. Forcing people to go through a middleman to access the joys of life is a way to extract value. The psychiatrist, Pornhub, the social media site, the church, the museum, the gym, the landlord, how necessary are they really? In America especially, consumers are not trusted to make smart decisions for themselves. In many other countries, it is much easier to go to the pharmacy and request what you need. Marriages do not need to be approved by the state. Art is shown on the street. Public exercises are done at the park or are just a part of daily living. Worship is done in the home. The landlord is more pervasive, but how can someone own the land? I understand people who are paid for maintenance, for making sure that living conditions are safe. But what could possibly entitle someone to ownership of the earth we all live on? It seems like such a foreign and strange idea to me. I came home from 9 days in New York of bookings back to back. Anna picked me up at the airport and I started crying. I was just so burnt out. She promised me we would have fun, take some time off, and just play video games. I invited Akira over to play some video games. We were sitting in the living room, and I was about to take an edible and get incredibly stoned when Anna busted in. She told me that I needed to get ready because I had a booking in the South Bay in an hour and a half. I said I was taking the week off to relax after the tour, I said. Well, it's just a quick 1 hour, and we really need the money, Anna said. At this point, I asked Akira to leave the room. Anna berated me, telling me that I was being lazy, that we couldn't afford to miss out on this booking. I didn't have the mental energy to say no. I was crying when I opened the door and told Akira that we couldn't play together. I had to take this booking. Some days, I would wonder about my old friends and acquaintances in New York and Google them. One of my old friends had a solo show at the Whitney. Another had an incredibly popular pop-up at Art Basel. Someone else's magazine had taken off. I would miss them. I invited a bunch of escorts I was interested in being friends with to a dinner in NYC. Everyone seemed so cool, and I was nervous meeting them. As we talked over dinner, I began to realize how many girls in the literary and art scenes in NYC were escorts. Two of the girls, Sophia and Mia, had been friends of mine when I was more active in the art scene. Some artists I had been familiar with while she was still going to Pratt had recently blown up for revealing that she had been doing Instagram as a performance art and talked about being an escort and a hot girl online. She was featured in a massively popular group show about social media at the Tate. We talked about how frustrating it was, that her work was borderline whorephobic, but that we loved it nonetheless. When I told Anna about seeing them again, I told her I was thinking of emailing other old friends, catching up. She forbade me. What if they outed me again? As if outing someone as a serial predator and a rapist is some great crime. Anna eventually hung out with Sophia and Mia anyways. She traveled with me to New York to shoot some photos during my tour. Amini and Alexa also flew out from LA. We all stayed in the same hotel together. Sophia wanted to go to a party together, so she swung by our hotel room beforehand. Anna had a headache, so she left some Tylenol on the bed. "Are these for me?" Sophia cooed, playing with the pills. "That's my Tylenol," Anna laughed, "but you can have it if you want." Alexa had brought some MDMA with her. It was powdered, and she was offering to put it in everyone's ass. "It gets absorbed faster that way," she said. Amini and Sophia went into the restroom with Alexa. Anna lay on the bed in the hotel bathrobe. "I don't want to have an orgy," Anna said. "I think it's much cooler to have hot sex workers want to fuck me, but then I don't actually fuck them. Like, it's cooler to turn down sex with a porn star than it is to actually have sex with a porn star." "Okay," I said. We went to the party, which was some new techno BDSM party that was super hot at the time. Everyone was wearing leather and fetish gear. It was in some grungy Bushwick club, and I loved it. Amini was rolling, and we made out on the dance floor, lit by strobe lights, as a short, androgynous DJ with a shaved head expertly mixed tracks. She fingered me, and I moaned against her. Alexa, Anna, and Sophia sat in a booth, had drinks, and watched the scene. Beautiful nights, full of community, fun, and laughter, made the brutal amount of work I was doing almost bearable. My community and the joyous time I had with my favorite clients. I love very easily. I can see the best parts of people without trying too hard, the things that make them delightful, their talents, their vulnerabilities. I love making people feel cared for. Perhaps that is a large part of why I started doing sex work in the first place. I've often said to others that I love more than most. I care about strangers as much as many people care about their friends. Friends I value like lovers, and lovers I would do nearly anything for. It doesn't feel like a burden. If I took anything away from my Christian upbringing, it's that loving others is a joy in and of itself. My cup overflows. Giving food to a hungry stranger or listening to a friend vent about their breakup over tea bring me joy. Being generous is its own reward. Learning about boundaries and how to give on my own terms was something that Christianity never taught me, though. We were taught to turn the other cheek. I had to learn how to walk away as well. Being generous doesn't mean you need to be a martyr. You can help more people if you nurture yourself. Bleeding out on a cross to prove a point only hurts the ones who love you. For me personally, sex is something that is less emotional than it is for most. My colleagues themselves have such a range of views on the work. Some, like me, get a voyeuristic pleasure from the work. Sex can be more about seeing into someone than about experiencing pleasure. Especially when I first started having sex, the novelty was particularly exciting to me. Even if the sex was not orgasmic or even pleasurable, just getting into someone's head like that was so fascinating. I'm the type of sex worker, and there are many of us, who delight in strange requests from clients, who read about psychology and sexuality and apply it in all of our bookings, approaching the work almost as a type of therapy. Other girls I knew just unabashedly loved the sex. One girl went on and on about the multi-orgasmic romps she had with clients. When I first heard her, I thought she was bluffing. But as we grew closer, she would sometimes call me in tears, telling me her client wasn't leaving his wife after all. "Oh," I thought, "you really are into him." For some people, physical intimacy can feel overwhelmingly intense. One girl told me the work was traumatic for her. She felt like she was giving something of herself she would rather not. I was horrified when I heard this, of course. She was one of the most successful escorts in New York. Beautiful, fun, loving, kind. I had done doubles with her, and usually I was the one who took care of the actual fucking. She told me she would sometimes make over $80,000 a month. She was supporting her family, and she didn't feel like she could stop. There was her mother, who was disabled, and her sister, who had a college tuition to pay. There were people who relied on her. What could she do? It pained me to see her doing work that exacted such a spiritual cost on her. Even if the sexual aspect of our jobs felt largely impersonal to me, it was clearly sacred for her. I've often wondered why sex is considered so sacred to so many people. Don't have sex with your friends. It could change the relationship. Perhaps it's because my friends and I are sluts, but I've never had a friendship end over sex. Resentments or bad communication, in my experience, are far more likely to destroy a relationship. Perhaps it is the meaning so many people imbue sex with that gives it such power to kill. Sex, for me, has never been about power. It's always shocking to me when someone says that. Desire, of course, can give you power. But sex? The sex I have is usually just about pleasure. But perhaps it's inevitable that people who are unused to pleasuring themselves freely can't handle sex. Some people seem to think you can only have a good fuck if you're making love. I don't think love necessarily has anything to do with sex, either. Sex can be an act of love, but so can making someone breakfast, holding their hand, giving them a thoughtful gift. People complain about how fraught it is to be fuck buddies. Don't fall in love. Just talk about whatever you're feeling, for fuck's sake. Of course, it's always challenging navigating everyone's boundaries. Some people only want to have sex if they're in a relationship, which is fine. Or they only want to have sex with a condom if they're not, also fine. Where most of these things break down is when no one talks about their expectations, or they lie. Perhaps people's misconceptions about sex have to do with a lack of experience. The first few times you orgasm with someone, it does feel intense and intimate, of course. But you could say the same thing about going to see a personal trainer, the dentist, or getting your hair cut. Personally, getting my hair cut is far more intimate for me than having sex. This person is going to physically change your body. They're washing you, styling you, in absolute control over your fate. The first time I got my hair cut at a salon, I cried and cried. I hated how I looked. I insisted on cutting my hair myself for years, unwilling to trust anyone else with it. It took me years to find a stylist I trusted. Is there something wrong with me that I can come with a stranger whose name I haven't gotten yet on some crowded dance floor? Is it wrong that I feel comfortable fucking an older man who's paying me? It's deviant, to be sure, but if it's so wrong, I can't say I mind. When I hear people talking about tantric sex, some sort of epic soul connection, I roll my eyes. Of course, there's an intimacy to sex, a baseline level of trust one should have with your partner. But at the end of the day, I'd rather have bad sex than a bad haircut. When you are young, it is easy to idolize someone older you admire who seems to have their life together. It is easy to ignore red flags and let others decide what your boundaries are because you are still putting them together yourself. Sometimes when you love someone, you give them power over you. Anna hurt me. You can walk down many narratives of power and portray the relationship from different angles, like a doctor performing a biopsy. Perhaps the overworked liver indicates alcoholism, or maybe it was the heart. When my grandmother on my father's side died, the sheer number of conditions they rattled off unnerved me. Ovarian cancer, obesity, heart disease, undiagnosed mental illness. When she had heard that I had cluster headaches, my inheritance from her, she broke down sobbing and told my father she should never have given birth. Perhaps another disease she died from is misogyny. How many times does someone die of bigotry and we give it another label, putting the blame on their own body? What happens when someone dies of hypothermia, sleeping on the street? Was it really hypothermia? What was the reason they were out that night? Did they not have a home in the literal sense of housing? Did they not have a home in the sense of safety? We can put people in soulless beds and soulless rooms, give them something to numb the pain, and pat ourselves on the back and walk away. We sometimes do the same thing to ourselves. We let ourselves clench our jaws and not say what it is that needs to be said. How do we dismantle this? It is immensely painful, and none of us are without complicity. Did I hurt Anna? I did. In different ways, of course, and I do believe ultimately the power dynamic was grossly in her favor. I was 16 when we met. She was nearly a decade older than me. She had more money. She had institutional connections, and she had legal advantages. Of course, when you are young and in love, you want to make someone happy. And at the start of the relationship, while I was so eager to please, she was happy. I never told her I was unhappy with the way we split the bills. I didn't tell her how much the sex hurt, that I rarely orgasmed, if ever. I didn't tell her how angry I was. Some people will read that I had an abusive partner during the start of my sex work career and believe that I was coerced into the work. This couldn't be further from the truth. In fact, it was something we had many arguments about. I wanted to do it, and initially Anna didn't want me to. Finally, I laid down an ultimatum. I would be doing sex work. She could either get over it, or we could break up. It is a challenging thing to admit that someone you loved was abusive. While escorting, I felt more able to set boundaries. I felt comfortable telling my clients to slow down or to touch me differently because I wasn't as worried about being rejected by them. I didn't need their love, and there were plenty of men with money who were eager to see me if they refused to respect me. Some clients were absolutely sublime. There was one client during those first years that shocked me. I remember the sex felt perfect, no pain, just absolute pleasure. He was a writer and had written a memoir I liked. He was very eager, very neurotic, and very kind. Part of what was so hot was he had no desire to be in a romantic relationship with me, and he was not at all jealous. We could really fuck with no strings attached. I remember laughing after, wondering why I could have such an easy, pressure-free experience with a client who is supposed to be scum of the earth according to what most people think of clients, while my wife pressured me repeatedly into the most painful sex of my life. Last year in LA, I met up with him again. We had coffee first in the hotel lobby. He's someone I see every so often. He sees a few of my friends, and we all adore him. He is cool, so I felt comfortable dressing casually. I was wearing a tie-dye shirt that said Daddy on it. Do you like my shirt? I said, smirking, mischievous. He chuckled. I guess I am old enough to be your daddy. No, I laughed, pouted. I'm the daddy. He grinned. I like that. We went back to the hotel room and made out, kissed, tumbled around together, and it felt as good as it always had. He has boyish good looks that could easily make you think he's in his 30s, but he told me he had just turned 50. I don't know if I can believe you, I said, kissing him on the nose. You're a scoundrel. I fantasized about leaving Anna and running off with Amini. But she seemed like someone I could never deserve to be with. How could I deserve to be that happy? To wake up next to someone who would smile at me, cook me something delicious, rub my tummy when I'm gassy, who I could sit in silence with. A beautiful quiet. The talking with Anna was incessant. If I didn't respond to a text, I was in trouble. God forbid I leave my phone unattended for a few hours while with a friend. She constantly spoke in narratives, telling me what role I was playing, explaining to me how I was bad, then prescribing the cure. My stomach was constantly in knots, and I would vomit without cause. I felt I could never say or do anything right, but it was the strangest thing. When I told her something she did made me unsafe, I was told I was the one who was abusive. I tried to break up with her over and over, but often couldn't even speak the words. I was afraid to drive, so she would always be sitting in the driver's seat. I would watch the hills of San Francisco move by as I imagined my mouth making the words and my lungs pushing air through, my tongue moving with my lips closed. I don't want to be with you. I would suggest it. I would look up apartments I could live in. I fantasized about moving back to New York. I fantasized about endless permutations of lives lived without her. She told me that if I left, I would fall flat on my face, that I had no possibility of success without her. Who else could put up with me? I believed her. I was a mess. So I worked. I made more money than I ever dreamed I could make. I toured constantly. I worked all day until my pussy was sore and bleeding, and all I could do was curl up in a ball in bed and weep. I went to doctor after doctor, asking them why all sex had become so painful to me. My therapist said that it might be trauma-induced. She asked if the sex I was having with Anna was consensual. I told her that I said yes to the sex, but when I didn't say yes, it became an argument. I didn't feel like I could say no. I often had doubts about my relationship with Anna, but they always felt outweighed by the great kindnesses she bestowed upon me. Once I was rejected at the border of a foreign country, they figured out who I was and didn't want me to enter. It was such an utterly humiliating experience. I watched as an older, cranky woman picked through my belongings with gloves, grunted in disgust at the sight of my dildo. I started to cry. One of the other customs agent, who seemed to pity me for being selected by this nasty lady, handed me a tissue and a glass of water. I asked if I could play the video game I had brought while she searched. I couldn't bear watching. She demanded I unlock my phone for her, and I asked why. She said it was a requirement to make sure I didn't have child pornography on my phone. She scrolled through my text messages with my mom, and I asked her why she felt the need to violate my privacy like this. "Does your mom know what you do?" she asked, disgust on her face, her desire to make me cry further, completely transparent. I grimaced, unwilling to take the bait. "Of course she does." After the awful woman was done humiliating me, they marched me through the airport in handcuffs and sent me back to the States. They couldn't find a flight back to San Francisco, so they decided to just send me back to LAX. When I protested, saying I wouldn't be able to book a hotel, I wouldn't know where to stay, it was too late in the night, they shrugged. "It's in California. It's close enough." Although I didn't find it humorous in the moment, it is funny how people in general think the distance between LA and SF is negligible. It's a 6-hour drive at least. I will never forget how Anna drove down to meet me that night, speeding along the way. She called a friend and we were able to crash at their place. She held me until I stopped shaking from anxiety. How could someone who would do all that be abusive? I thought I was smart enough that I couldn't be taken advantage of. I doubted myself, my body, my pain. I had been trained to from childhood. Being seen is the antidote. Amity held my hand when I was crying, both of us wordless. In some ways, she showed me how to speak. I had always done LSD with Anna, and, while I enjoyed it, I associated tripping with near unbearable anxiety. But Amity took me to a beautiful and strange earthship out in the middle of Taos, New Mexico. Off the grid, solar paneled, chickens in the backyard, and fruits in the greenhouse which modulated the temperature of the apartment. I had never had such a beautiful trip before. There was no anxiety. But she told me something that night that broke my heart. We were lying in bed and I was talking about Alexa from Los Angeles. I was excited because she had finally broken up with her creepy partner, Douglas. When I told Amity that Alexa seemed to be in a healthier spot, her body shifted. Her face grew dark and angry, disgusted. "What's wrong?" I asked. The things they did to me, they were unspeakable. I told her that if she wanted to talk about it, she could. I held her. I was angry beyond words. I'm not sure she had ever spoken about what had happened before. But when she did, she was so powerful. She stood up from the bed, back straight. I watched as her self-doubt peeled away as she described what had happened to her. Sometimes, in our impulse to protect others, we lie to ourselves.